Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with a Kia EV6, the fully electric EV6 with a range of up to 528 kilometres. For more, visit kia.com.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Margaret, it happened last night. What happened?
Well, at around seven, it's about half seven.
Okay.
My son broke his leg four months ago.
Okay.
And he's been very careful. And last night was the first night he went out. And he was literally out the door for maybe 15 minutes, five to 15 minutes, and he broke his leg again.
Okay.
He came off one of them electrical scootery things, whatever it was.
Yeah. And when you say a leg break, how severe was the leg break?
Very severe. He had shattered his tibia and his fibula.
Okay. So basically, when you shatter, for turn away your ears now, but when you shatter your tibia and your fibula, you're basically, you've lost any communication between your knee and your ankle, and your leg is just swinging freely.
Yeah.
I know, because...
He had already got bars in his leg from the first accident, and we were waiting for them to be taken out.
All right.
And they had kind of mangled in his leg as well.
Good God. And was he in pain? He obviously was.
He was in an awful lot of pain. He was in an awful lot of shock.
Yeah.
Now, the situation happened was my friend had to go over and take him out of a ditch that he was in.
Right.
And now, you're not supposed to move someone with a break like that. I was told the last time, never, ever, because they have to be compressed. The leg has to be compressed. But we had no other option. We were waiting 2 hours with him sitting in a car, freezing. He was shaking.
So you rang the fire brigade?
You rang the
999 ambulance service in Dublin City and County, which is run by Dublin Fire Brigade. What happened?
They said they'd be out as soon as they could. So the first hour, I rang them back, I think, once. The second hour then, I'd rang them three times altogether. And the last phone call, they said to me, look, we have them on a list. We'll get you as soon as possible. I says, can you tell me in around how long we're talking?
Mm-hmm.
He says, another couple of hours. I says, what? He says, well, there's 48 people in front of him.
Waiting for an emergency ambulance.
Waiting for an emergency ambulance.
In the capital city of a civilised nation.
That's it.
One of the richest nations in the world.
Yeah.
They told you after 2 hours, and I know they're stretched.
Yeah. Now, it wasn't their fault. Now, don't get me wrong. Like, they were so helpful and they were so kind. Like, their hands were tied. Their hands were tied. There was absolutely nothing. Like, I was like, so...
And when they said there was 48, you dialed 999 you knew that his tibia and his fibula were broken previous.
It was a compound break.
Okay, which is a pretty serious...
Because
I know it happened to me when I was knocked down that time and they were there.
Yeah.
Well, I was about 2 minutes from Tara Street Fire Station, luckily enough, when I was hit by the car. But anyway, that was reversing. But...
Yeah.
They said to you, there are 48 people prioritised in front of you. Do you follow me?
No, 48 people in front of us. Now, they knew that it was a bad break.
Okay.
They knew that, you know, this is also a serious call. It would have been up at the top with the heart attacks and the strokes, like.
But it wasn't life-threatening?
No, it wasn't life-threatening, no.
But they said there's 48 people in front of you. Front of
48
him.
People in front of us, yeah.
Okay,
there was another woman that had come into the hospital when I had gotten in there. Now, you can imagine he was roaring and screaming. He was so sore and going over every bump because his leg wasn't compressed.
And how did you get to the hospital?
I had to get a taxi.
With a broken tibia and fibula?
Yeah.
Swinging?
Swinging, yeah.
Who lifted him into the ambulance?
Both me and my friend.
Taxi.
And his friend.
And how was he as you were doing that?
He was in shock. I think he was just in shock. He was in pain and shock. Like, you could just see his face was grey.
Yeah. He's 15. Stay there, Margaret. Yeah. So you hired a taxi to bring him into what? Temple Street at A&E?
Yeah.
Okay, stay there for a sec. Michelle, born 51551, joe at rt.ie, 1850 715 815. The emergency ambulance service in Dublin is up again for these are calls we got just this morning. Michelle.
Hi, Joe. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. How are you doing? And it was two weeks ago. What happened?
Yeah, it's 3 weeks this Friday. I picked my mum up from the dentist on the Ballymun Road. She stepped into the car herself. She put the seatbelt on. And the minute she clipped the seatbelt, she fell forward and her breathing became really laboured. Mm-hmm. She started talking gobbledygook. And I was saying, man, take the mask off. I don't know what you're saying, because sometimes with the mask off, you know, I'm being to the dentist. And so I said, man, take the mask off. I really don't know what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Now, she was able to take the mask off. And I said to her, have you to go back? And she said to me, clearly, the 4th of October. And that was the last clear thing that she was able to say. So that was on the Ballymun Road. My mum lives in Santry. Mm-hmm. My senses were telling me, this is a stroke. But I'm saying, no, couldn't be. You know, so I decided, I said, I'll take her home and see how it got on. Got to her house in Chanlis, which is a 3-minute drive.
Yeah, Santry.
And a neighbour of mine came out and I said, will you give me a hand here, ma'am? And then I said, oh no, I think I'll get an ambulance. And my neighbour agreed. Mm-hmm. Rang 999.
And what state was your mother in now?
She was open, eyes open. Mm-hmm. Totally blank. She could move. She could move her arms, but she was a dead weight. There's no way we would have got her out of the car. So I rang the ambulance guy. He said, "Can you do a few tests?" I said, "I can't because she's breathing. Mm-hmm. Her eyes are open, but she's not focused. She's blank." So he said, "Okay, well, you won't be able to run the test I wanted." But he said, "Unfortunately," he said, "there's about a 2.5-hour waiting list to get." But I said, "I'm nearly sure this is a stroke. I'm mm-hmm. positive this is a stroke." And he said, "I'm sorry." He said, "Can you just tell me again where your mum is?" And I said, "She's in the car. She happened to me beside her in the car." So twice he asked me where he was. And then I realised, hang on a minute, is he suggesting? I said, "Oh, well, I bring her to A&E myself." And he goes, "Not at all. I'm not suggesting that at all," he said. "But if you do choose to go to A&E, mm-hmm. will you please ring us back?" So the easiest thing in the world was for me to throw the seatbelt back on her, mm-hmm. take her down to A&E. My sister lives in Beaumont Woods, which is just the estate next to
the hospital,
and I rang her on the way. She said she'd meet me at the gates of the hospital. I rang the ambulance guys back, mm-hmm. and they talked to me right the way through. They said, "Have you any help?" I said, "No. Can they tell me where you are now?" I said, "I'm on the bridge. I'm on Chantala Road. I'm at the Beaumont House." He stayed with me right the way through, and my sister got in the car. I said, "I have help now." And he said, "That's great." He said, "The best of luck to you." Got to the ambulance bay in Beaumont Hospital, mm-hmm. and I just opened the car myself. My sister was like flatless chickens running around, and the security man came over and he goes, "You can't park your car there." And I said, "Listen, can you please help me? My mum was having a stroke in front of the car."
Okay.
And like that, he was out with a wheelchair. There was no issue. The car was not an issue. So it was 17 minutes from the time mm-hmm. that had happened at the dentist and to the hospital.
And was she diagnosed with a stroke?
She has been, yeah. She has been, yeah. Okay. Yeah, she's had...
Now, the thing we're told about strokes, and it's actually on the side of Dublin Fire Brigade Ambulances and the National Ambulance Service.
Yeah.
You'll see it fast, and the fast is...
F
for facial drooping, A for arm weakness, S for speech difficulties, mm-hmm. and T for time. And time is call the emergency services immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I don't know if she was in the house, how fast they might have been ahead of that. If I was ringing them again, like that lady had to do, you know, I don't know where she would have been put in the list. But if the gods were with her for anything and it wasn't for the stroke, it was for where she took it in the car.
Yeah, about 15 minutes from
And
moment.
Again, like, now, Michelle, I want to stress in my email what I said to you was, this is no reflection on
They
you
can
know,
only work with the resources
for sure, yes,
and the system
yes.
that they have. Now, Michelle... when you, I don't know if you could even recall this, when you sped into the A&E bay at the side of Beaumont there,
what,
did you notice many ambulances?
Two,
okay.
Two, there was loads of room for me to pull in.
Well, I think there's 12 ambulances in the 999 service in Dublin City and County. It obviously isn't enough.
Mm-hmm.
Margaret, when you arrived in Temple Street in the taxi with your son in the back seat, who lifted him? We know who lifted him in, obviously, but who lifted him out?
A security guard had to help me.
And how did you get into A&E then? Did you have to run in and say, help, or...
I had to run in and ask him, I said, like, my son, because I was afraid an ambulance was going to come down behind us, so I was panicked anyway because of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I just jumped out of the taxi and ran in, and there's a security man that stands at the front of the hospital.
Yeah.
So he had to run and get a wheelchair from, like, his leg was severely deformed, severely deformed. Now, I have to say, when we got in, mm-hmm. they took him off me straight away.
Great.
And brought him in, got him the x-rays, he can't have the operation till tomorrow because they need the parts. Sounds like for a car.
but they need to get bigger bolts. Okay.
And how
a bigger bar.
And how is he today?
He's on morphine today.
Well, I just this is anecdotal, but as I said, just like a car. When I was knocked down, the exact same injuries, tib and fib broke, leg swinging from below the knee. I got those metal bars in. And the surgeon told me in St. James's Hospital, if you're knocked down again, he was laughing. He said, if you're knocked down again, don't come to me, go to a panel beater. You have so much metal in your leg.
That's what they're worried about. They're afraid that the marrow is going to come out of the bone because he shattered the bone this time. So they're afraid the marrow is going to come out of the bone and go into his bloodstream. So that's going to be a serious issue that we have as well while he's having the operation. I'm just so worried for other people as well. Like, we're in the middle of a pandemic and we've only got 12 ambulances. It's scary to think, you know, like that woman, her mother had a stroke and she would have been waiting 2.5 hours. You know, and that's the time.
And it's ongoing, unfortunately, because we've done this before.
Another lady in there had to bring her child in choking.
Because?
Had to bring her child in choking because she couldn't get an ambulance.
And how was the child?
Drive the car in with her daughter holding the baby.
Oh, good God.
Yeah.
And it can be so dangerous. Well, if you're in a state driving a car and you're distracted and worried and you're hitting lights.
Gosh, my legs were wobbly when I seen his leg. Yeah. I got that panicked over it. Like, there's no way I would have even been able to drive. I was shaking that much looking at him. It was horrendous.
Well, that was a good. Whose idea was it then to get a taxi?
I had no other choice.
Well, that was a good idea because you meant you didn't have to drive. But the preference would be it was an emergency ambulance service. Now, David Hall, you all know, Irish Mortgage Holders Association, and other titles as well. But David also runs an ambulance service and is called in. David, you're listening to these stories again as we are. What's gone wrong in Dublin?
Well, I think, Joe, this is something you spoke about recently. Many other media outlets have spoken it during the summer and in the last number of years. We don't have an appropriate ambulance service for the country. We don't have a professional management structure in place. Like, 12 ambulances for the city hasn't changed. This is the Dublin Fire Brigade have brilliant paramedics and great staff providing a service under a massive pressure on contract to the health service executive. And there's no resources there. And you heard multiple callers saying about having 40 calls ahead. It happened to me recently where I came across a lady who fell in outside St. Peter's Church. And again, I was told by the guys that was there, I was number 14 on the list. Mm-hmm. One of my own ambulances was down the mat and they came up and took the lady to hospital.
Because you run the Lifeline Ambulance Service.
Yeah, I've contracted to the HSE and we're number one in the contract nationally. So they've already vetted us and three other companies. They could use any one of those companies to help with the backlog that they have at any given day in Dublin and around the country.
Who called you in? Is it the Fire Brigade called you in or the HSE?
Well, none have done so in 20 years and they've chosen not to. So they play roulette with lives each day. They choose not to make the phone call. They leave private ambulance companies, not just my own. There's other ambulance companies, unfortunately, as good as mine around the country and indeed in Dublin who could be utilised and are already vetted by the HSE. We have the same standing as the HSE, same insurance, same licensing, same certification, same staff, same vehicles, same equipment, same servicing. And they choose to stack and rack patients like animals and not to have a system in place to save lives.
Can Dublin Fire Brigade not call in the National Ambulance Service?
Well, I've said to you before, Joe, and something I've looked for the last number of years, I think there needs to be an independent review of the relationship between Dublin Fire Brigade and HSE. I think there's a lack of honesty in relation to how that relationship has happened over the last 30 years. Have there been any risk to lives? Has there been any deterioration of patients? I think, you know, there needs to be a look and not having a segregation of silos of different ambulance services.
Are you saying there's bad blood between DFB?
The dogs in the street know that, Joe.
Well, what is the bad blood about? Pardon the
pun. I don't know. It's a historical issue. It's gone on for 30, 40 years. It's improved recently. But I think over that period of time, I think there's an honest review looked. But, you know, as to what happened, why has it happened, and why are there not additional resources? Why are there 40 patients queuing in a system in a capital city? 48. Why are there so many people queuing? And why isn't there a lower tier service in Dublin to take the broken legs, to take the non-acute, non-urgent calls. We have a very fortunate situation in Dublin, Joe, but it's unfortunately compensating for the lack of ambulances, where the Dublin Fire Brigade have an immense number of qualified and experienced paramedics, including ones who can go out on fire engines. We're dispatching fire engines instead of ambulances with six people on them, waiting for an ambulance to arrive.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Joe.
Yes, Michelle, is it Michelle? Yeah.
No, it's Margaret. I asked the ambulance service last night, I said, is there anything else I can do? You know, I was nearly crying down the phone. I was like, he's in so much pain. I said, is there any other place I can ring for help? And they said, no. They said, no. But I didn't know that there was another ambulance service, you know, that I could have.
Well, there has to be,
emergency service. I even asked them to send me over a fire brigade.
But there has to be a plan B if there was a major disaster. And the plan B is, it's a plan that's in writing. They call in. You go to the next, you call in the National Ambulance Service, then you call in the likes of David Hall, Lifeline, then you call in the Red Cross, the Order of Malta, whatever, if there was an emergency.
Yeah.
So there is, and the Civil Defence, by the way, have a great service as well, as we heard last week from one of its members, or 2 weeks ago when they were, what were we talking about, Peter Naffin, the firefighter who was couldn't get married. He would lose his pension if he didn't get married. What's happening there? He'd lose his pension if he couldn't get married by last Friday, I think. We must find. But the Civil Defence have, so David, is there a piece of paper saying if Dublin Fire Brigade, the 12 ambulances are engaged, which invariably they are, a lot of the time they could be waiting at hospitals to get their equipment back. Is there anything on paper that says, well, the next port of call is the NAS, National Ambulance Service, and the next port of call is the private companies?
Yeah, I think we need to be clear. Like, this is not Dublin Fire Brigade's fault.
I know that.
Dublin Fire Brigade have a gig to do, and they're doing it. But, like, I have the second largest ambulance service in the state. I've got 40 ambulances. Today I've got 6 ambulances empty as we speak in Dublin City, which is half the number of total ambulances the Dublin Fire Brigade have. And it's immoral to think. And by the way, just against myself, I'm going to say, Joe, our pricing structure, in case anyone thinks this is pricing, anybody competently who knew our contract with the HSE would know that the best value the HSE gets for calls, so to give you an average call cost for Dublin would be €90, just in case anyone thinks this is a financial consideration. If they actually knew what they were doing, they'd be giving me every call, every minute of every day, because it'd be cheaper than what they're currently paying. So this is not a financial issue, it's important to say. But they have a protocol to ring the National Ambulance Service, who clearly don't have the resources either to respond. And this is going on now for years, and no change has been taken. And these are circumstances where people, at the worst time and emergency times, need help and need support from the best staff in the world that we have between the various services you mentioned, yet the amount of ambulances just simply aren't available.
Okay, stay there, David. Joe at rt.ie, 51551 is the text number. Terry Webb. Terry, you're a retired firefighter and paramedic. Your own story, Terry.
Yes, good afternoon, Joe. I was in the unfortunate position that my wife had a stroke here about 4 or 5 weeks ago.
Okay.
And I had to put in a call to Dublin Fire Brigade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was getting a bit 15 minutes or thereabouts, and Skerries, the appliance who are retained station, they appeared at the door.
Great.
And it was oxygen we needed for the start, because my wife's breathing wasn't very, very good at the time. And about 10 minutes later, two advanced paramedics arrived who were on the north side and probably around Beaumont or thereabouts.
Okay, this is in the, it's a like a minivan.
It's the Volkswagen.
It's brilliantly equipped and it's brilliantly staffed, but they can't actually transport.
But they arrived in, Joe, and got stuck in immediately.
Okay.
And within about 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an ambulance arrived at the door from Tarda Street Fire Station, who were also up at Beaumont. Now, that was all in the space of about less than half an hour. And within an hour, my wife had been brought into the hospital. She had had a scan, and they had cleared the blockage in her brain.
Because she had a stroke, the woman, unfortunately.
Yes. Now, she's at home, Joe, and she's improving all the time.
Great, great.
But, one thing I'd like to say to you. There have been, someone said that there were 12 ambulances. There have been an addition in 4. One extra in North Strand.
Mm-hmm.
an extra one in, as far as I'm aware, in Phibsborough Fire Station, Dolphins Barn Fire Station, and an ambulance where there was never one before in Dunleary.
So you're saying, there's 16?
There's 16. Well,
but when Linda or Michelle rang for her mother was having a stroke, she was told to be 2 hours. When Margaret rang last night, when her son broke his tibia and his fibia, she was told there was 48 people ahead of her.
Yes, I understand that, Joe. But don't forget now, you have the four, what we got. Every ambulance is going, and they're nearly going 24 hours a day.
I know that.
So when you get to a hospital, you have to have all the details for the nurse who takes all the details from you. So that takes about 10 minutes. After you've given your patient into A&E, you have to give all the details in and then get back on the road.
So in other words, there's a time commitment when the ambulance arrives at the hospital.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, is there any way, does Dublin Fire Brigade call in the National Ambulance Service when they're extraordinarily busy?
Yes, they do, Joe.
Which seems to be, but then last night, why didn't they call in the National Ambulance Service when they told Margaret there's 48 people ahead of you?
I'm wondering where the National Ambulance up to their eyes as well.
Yeah, because I asked them to, I said, look, can you send a fire brigade or something? Because I was very concerned about them. I was very worried about them. Like, I got absolutely no help. Like, they were like, why would we send a fire brigade to you? I said, because he needs some sort of pain relief before I can even try and move him.
Yeah, I understand. You know, that's a dreadful injury, a compound fracture.
Yeah, it was horrendous. Like, I had to literally, like, he had to be literally lifted and put into a taxi, which went over every bump with his leg like that, which we could have done more damage to him. Like, that could have bone or the bar could have came through.
Yeah, that's very true.
You know,
well,
it was horrendous
now.
And Terry,
I'm not blaming the fire brigade.
Terry, would you have been aware that the David Hall's Lifeline, as it's called, private ambulance service is available to the HSE? They have a contract with the HSE.
Well, I don't know anything about that, Joe. Like, I had to see the Lifeline ambulance on the road, but I don't know what kind of work that they do.
Well, he says his paramedics are trained to the same standard, which is a very high standard, as a DFP. Linda, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Good. What happened?
Well, my sister had a bad fall there a couple of weeks ago, and God love her, she has multiple system atrophy, the same disease as Garrett O'Callaghan. She had a terrible fall and ended up kind of going forwards and fell backwards, ended up with a compound fracture in her back.
Okay.
Anyway, she called the ambulance, and after 2 hours she rang back, well, her husband and the daughter rang back, and they said that there was a bad accident and that they were on a long list, and the ambulance didn't call to the house for 4 hours. So, and like that, you know, other callers there as well.
And did you look at the option,
Joe,
as Margaret had to, for a taxi or a private car?
Because it was the back, you know, my sister and, well, the husband and daughter were absolutely terrified to move her in case they did more damage. They did end up getting her up off the floor and had her in a position that was as comfortable as possible for her at the time, you know.
They didn't want to risk it. And did the ambulance come after 4 hours?
Yeah, 4 hours they came, yeah.
And just to be clear, where did this happen?
Well, she lives in County Wicklow.
Okay, so that would have been the National Ambulance Service that covers outside the Dublin City and County.
She said once the guys got there, they couldn't have been any nicer.
Absolutely,
you know?
That's a universal cry.
Yeah,
it's a universal call and a universal answer, but there definitely is a problem with time delays. Terry, you wanted to come in there.
Sorry, yes, Joe. I just to explain something to you. As the calls come in and the ambulances are all tied up, the calls are queued.
I know.
Okay?
Yeah.
And then if in the need, they will call in the health board. Well, I call it the health board, the HSE.
Yeah.
They will call them in if needed. Because there is a HSE ambulance in Swords.
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen those lads out at accidents.
Is there enough of them? Because that's when you're told it's 40, your son is lying on the ground in terrible pain with a tib and a fib. You know, Terry's a pretty severe break.
Oh, dreadful!
And you're told actually by a really decent member at the other end of the phone and control room, you're told, well, there's 48 people in front of you. God, well, what state were they in if they were in front of you?
I understand that, Joe, but unfortunately, that's the system. You know,
a lot of people having heart attacks last night, so I was told.
Well,
heart attacks and strokes. So.
Yeah, strokes. Strokes seem to be every couple of hours. I don't know what it's from. I've never heard of so many people having strokes.
Yeah, and blood clots as well, I was told last night.
Well, Joe...
It's horrendous. We need a lot. And I said that to them, I was begging and pleading. There has to be something else I can do. I couldn't give them any pain relief. I wasn't allowed to feed them. I wasn't allowed to give them water. I wasn't allowed to do anything. So he was 2 hours just in pain.
Exactly the same as my sister, absolutely in agony, as you can imagine, with a compound fracture, you know, in her back, not being able to move, no painkiller, no. And then by the time she got into the hospital, thankfully the guys in the ambulance were able to give her some gas, I think, you know, just to...
Mm-hmm.
Then by the time she got into the hospital and was seen to, but, I mean, it ended up that it was practically 6 hours by the time the fall had happened.
Yeah. Okay. And how is she now, Linda?
She's in a full, she's in a back brace and will have it on. Like, that was nearly 5 weeks ago and she's still in this awful back brace. It's just a nightmare, to be honest, but as always, has a brave face.
And Terry, insofar as you can, is there bad blood between the National Ambulance Service and Dublin Fire Brigade going back to a strike 30 years ago?
After the strike in 88, but I mean, there are young lads now that have, the whole job has completely changed. And the people who were involved in the strike, 68 and 88...
And what would have happened then is that the Dublin Fire Brigade, obviously they were on strike for better pay because they were badly paid.
Yeah.
So the National Ambulance Service answered the calls, is that it?
That's right, Joe.
Were they seen as strike breakers in the back of the day?
I didn't see it as that, Joe, but the thing about it is...
But there was bad blood after that.
When you see an ambulance driving by the likes of Dolphins Barn and the lads are outside with pickets and they're on strike, and these smart alecks are holding up their cheques, waving their cheques out the window to say, look how much overtime I got this week.
And is that what happened in 88?
Oh, yeah.
So the National Ambulance Service staff at that time were...
Well, I mean, it shouldn't be like that now, Joe.
Of course it shouldn't.
Because it's a completely different attitude from the younger lads that are in there.
Yeah.
I mean, I was at a funeral the other day, Joe. I didn't know any of them.
One
of the lads out of the fire brigade had died, but that I had worked with.
Okay.
But the young lads, I didn't know one of them. So it's the likes of that now should be gone out of the job.
Okay, June, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jill. How are you?
Good. What happened?
Just the same that you researcher that I was in Abbey Street with my mum.
In Dublin.
And we, mum had an awful fall on the street there and had a big, huge bump, blood everywhere, a big bump onto her head, gash to her finger and all. So we got her up off the ground and sat her at a bus stop there.
Okay.
We rang the ambulance. After an hour, there was no response, so we rang the ambulance again.
Yeah.
And they said, she's in queue. I decided then to ring Door Street Garda Station, which is around the corner, to see if they could give me a hand to get my mum to hospital.
Okay.
Obviously, she suffers chronic back pain, so...
Well, she's 82.
82 years of age, yeah. So, they couldn't. They said all the patrols were out on jobs. And so I decided then, I said, I flagged down a taxi after 2 hours because I said, Mum was starting to get very cold. And I said to myself, no, I'm not leaving her here. So got a taxi up to James's hospital with her.
To the A&E in James. And what did the fire, what did the command, the control centre say when you dialed 999?
They just said that it was very busy. Some people were waiting up to 3 to 4 hours. And that they were sorry, like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course,
they were apologetic, but there was nothing they could do. It was out of their hands. So in the end, I just ended up cancelling. I rang and cancelled the ambulance then because I said to myself, I'll get her up in a taxi. I'd be quicker. Mm. But I waited for 2 hours before doing that.
Okay. And how is she
how
is she now, Joan?
She's doing well now. Like, this was about 6 or 7 weeks ago, so she's doing well now. She ended up having to get 17 stitches in her finger, all right, and the bumps and everything and the bruises and everything.
And you said while you were waiting, she was, which is always a
horrible
risk.
Horrible situation.
She was getting colder and colder.
Yes, she was freezing, like, do you know what I mean, at this stage. Yeah. So I said to myself, no, I said, the best thing to do now is to try and flag down a taxi. Which, I didn't think actually a taxi would take her because she was so covered in blood, but they did.
Okay,
so,
fair play to the taxi driver.
It was grand.
Okay.
So it worked out well in the end.
Yeah, I know, but still it's
just the highlight.
It's the worry, yeah. Okay, thanks indeed, Joe, okay. Linda, Michelle,
no
Terry, yes.
Joe, can I just pick you up on something there? There was a gentleman on a few minutes ago, I don't know, I think he was from Lifeline.
Yeah, David Hall, yeah.
Now, the what he said was that they were playing roulette with people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not fair, Joe.
Okay, well then, refute it then.
It's refuted. I refute it.
Okay, yeah.
These lads are gone.
Well, do you accept?
Oh,
no, and David Hall, in fairness, said that the one of the most professional groups and well trained groups he's ever come across in Dublin Fire Brigade. So what's the solution?
Well, I don't know what it is. The people have to try and work together. It's people's lives we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I always taught.
Yeah, here, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So,
sorry, okay. Joe, could I cut in there?
Yeah, who's that, Linda?
Yes.
It's Linda, yeah. I just wanted to say, obviously, like in Ireland, like there's so many people with rare diseases and that they're going to need ambulance care. So, like, what's down the line for these people? And, you know, the worry of it.
And we should remember in Scotland recently, they had to call in, the emergency ambulance service had to call in the army to help them. They were so, London Ambulance Service is constantly being criticised for delays and it's a different setup. But anyway, Linda, thanks indeed. David Hall, you're still there. And Terry was challenging your point there about...
No, look, as I say, I understand, Terry's point, but the reality is that this is not the staff on the road don't make the call around the number of ambulances that are available. This is a management issue. This is an issue for the Minister for Health. This is an issue for HICWA. There's not enough ambulances. There's lives being gambled. People have been put in a very unfortunate position, including staff. And listen to everyone. Every one of your callers is a common denominator and a common theme that everyone understands when they're in need, in their moment in time of need for themselves or the loved one. When they're in pain or they're suffering, they want people to come and help. We have the best staff to come and help. We don't have enough vehicles to bring them to help. It's a very simple mathematical equation, and it's been going on for years, and no one needs a PhD to understand that. The Minister for Health needs to act, and this is a national scandal, and there are lives at risk every single day as a direct result.
Okay.
David, I'd like to ask you,
Terry,
the statement that you made is people, they're playing with people's lives. They're playing with people's lives. I don't know who you mean by that.
But it's clear in the sense, Terry, is the HSE have responsibility for the ambulance service in the country. The Dublin Fire Brigade, as I, are contractors to the HSE. We provide a service to them. There's an inadequate amount of vehicles available to service the current needs of the population. The HSE are the ones, with the Minister for Health, the Department of Health, who need to step in and either give you double the ambulances or take in other ambulances from themselves or somewhere else. I'm not saying it's Lifeline they need to be ringing, but they most certainly need to ring somebody because there's a mathematical anomaly here that needs handling. And those who are responsible for this are the HSE.
Yes, I agree with that.
Okay.
But is the minister going to do anything about it, you see? But, and then again, David, some of the things that are going on, if you have COVID patients, if you have COVID patients and you turn up at the door, you have to tug out, as they say. And then you have to go in and you have to bring the person out into the back of the ambulance and you have to test them there. And so if it's COVID related, you have to take them into hospital, which delays everything.
The best response in the world to COVID was the ambulance staff in Ireland. History will judge the best response from all ambulance services. Okay, I guarantee you in history.
Okay, stay with us. More people after this break.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
It began with a phone call from Margaret and Michelle, both of them in Dublin. Margaret, last night, her son, 15, broke his tibia, and when she rang for the 999 ambulance service, she was told there was 48 people in front of her, so to speak. She waited 2 hours and then she hired a taxi and lifted him and brought him to A&E in Beaumont. Michelle, her mother had a stroke and she knew it immediately, and again there was a delay, so she drove to the A&E unit in Beaumont herself, and her mother was diagnosed with a stroke. And there have been other examples as well, Linda and June. Cora, what happened in your case?
My mother died in 2009. She was waiting. She was feeling unwell on a bus coming up from the train station in Dunleary. She got off at the next stop.
Okay.
A woman got off with her, an unknown woman that we still don't know who she was. Mm. And they brought her into a shop, which is beside the bus stop.
Okay.
The people in the shop got her a chair and put her up against the fridge. They got the first aid person from Dunleary Shopping Centre to ring five times for an ambulance. He analysed that she was having some sort of stroke or attack or whatever. So he rang and he was worried that she was going to get worse, and he kept ringing. They kept telling him it was on its way. Don't worry, it's on its way. My point of ringing, she was brought, an ambulance eventually came after, must have been an hour and a half or more, and they knew she was about 500 yards away from a hospital, St. Michael's Hospital in Dunleary. If she was brought to the hospital in Dunleary, she was triaged.
Yeah.
And she died. She died lack of oxygen. The thing about a heart or a heart attack or stroke is it has to be acted on within a certain amount of
fast.
Time.
It's called FAST.
FAST.
Yeah, it's the acronym, yeah.
Yeah, and at that time, I discussed that with the HSE, and I went and I did some private investigation myself on it.
Okay.
On what was the delay in the ambulance, all that, the times and everything. And I found out that, number one, if she'd have asked the question, or the person who called had asked the question, estimated time of arrival, it would have given her a choice to get into a taxi rank, which was right outside the door, bringing her 300 yards across the road to St. Michael's Hospital. But they kept saying to her, it's on the way, or him, the first aid person, it's on the way, it's on the way. So she put her trust in that. And I think since then, maybe if you ask that question, but you have to ask that question, the estimated time for arrival, in fairness,
a lot of people have been told it seems.
This must be because it wasn't a thing at the time, because they emphasised to me, oh, we don't give estimated times of arrival. But now the emergency ambulance service has
improved since then.
Thing I've learned from it was, when you ring 999 and you ask for the ambulance, it it's a HSE ambulance you're requesting. She could have got a Kill of the Grange ambulance, which was only up the road,
that was,
fire brigade. But they weren't notified. So the other question I would say is, okay, if you haven't got a service available, can you ring the fire brigade and ask them, have they one available?
Yeah, is there a plan B? Stay there, Cora, because David Kavanagh has contacted us and he wants to make an observation. Go ahead, David, and he knows something about this through his family. David, your point, please.
Yeah, John, I was basically just making the point that we can't Dublin Fire Brigade have a joint plan in place like a plan B, whereby you have a backup ambulance in every station. So that means then you have 12
Well, there stations. Are, like Tara Street is two ambulances, North Strand is two.
Unless you ask them to notify, they may not pass on that request.
But there should
it should be just brought in straight away. Like it's always a backup plan.
I thought that was the thing because I knew Kill of the Grange had but when I chased it up, and I asked the fire brigade, were you notified of a request for an ambulance? And they said no.
Okay, but I think the system has changed because Dublin City and County, there used to be a separate fire service in Dunleary, but that's now merged with Dublin Fire Brigade. And,
the other option would be they have motorbike oxygen.
Yeah, run by the HSE,
drivers.
Yeah.
And that was not requested either.
That's another, they're emergency vehicles, obviously motorbikes for obvious
that
reason.
Carry
they can
oxygen
get there
in the interim of an ambulance.
Okay. And David, what's your connection with the fire brigade?
My father served for 22 years in the fire brigade in Dublin, in Dolphin's Bank. And he highlighted this years ago when there was an ambulance strike, or a fire brigade strike, and he did emphasise what that other man said earlier on about the National Ambulance Service gone by. So there is a history there between the National Ambulance Service that was previously, you know. But I wouldn't say it's still there now.
Something has to change.
Yeah, well, you understand that, Joe. What I would emphasise is this, there should be two ambulances in each station. One in Dublin Fire Brigade, and the second one, the National Ambulance Service. So when the Fire Brigade goes out, the National Ambulance Service step into their position. So we always have a backup there. And then when the Fire Brigade come back
They don't have to be co-located. And this is in the world we live in where communications are instant.
Well, they don't really, but there's a big
I take your point, David. Yeah, okay, but something needs to change. Okay, David Kavanagh, thank you, and God rest your father, and thank him in retrospect for his service. Terry Webb, thank you for your service. David Hall, thank you for your service. And to our other callers, hope everyone makes a speedy and full recovery.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815. Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
And Joe at RT.ie. Dane Tighe. Dane, good afternoon. Can you tell us what happened? And sympathy, first of all, this is the savage attack on your brother-in-law in Wexford.
That's right, Joe. Yes. My brother-in-law was finishing work on Wednesday evening in a meat factory in Wexford town where he's worked for the last 7 or 8 months.
Okay.
And he left the plant at approximately 11:30. And because he's living in a temporary location, because he normally lives with myself and my wife, but because we're getting our house renovated, he's in a temporary location living with his mother in an apartment close to Wexford Town in an area called the Distillery Road.
Okay.
So he's taking a route home that he wouldn't normally take because he'd normally be coming to our house. But anyway, he left at 11:30. It was a Wednesday night. It was absolutely lashing rain. And he got to an area of Wexford Town, which is locally known as the Knock. I think it got that name from the Irish word Canuck, which means hill.
Okay.
And it's kind of a laneway that's on a hill, and it links two housing estates, one housing estate called St. Aidan's and the other called Bishop's Water. Now, it's to people who are familiar with Wexford Town, they would know that that would be an area that you wouldn't generally frequent because it's not very well regarded as a place. It's home to antisocial behaviour, and certain types would drink there, and there'd be lots of rubbish in cans there. I had no idea, my wife, who's a sister, we had no idea he was taking this route home. Chris is the kind of person, he's maybe there's a touch of innocence or a touch of naivety about him. But anyway, he was unfortunately taking this route called the knock, this laneway. Okay. And at about 10 to 12, maybe 5 to 12, he got a kick in the back. And he was sprung upon by two individuals, two males, mm-hmm. he says. Now, he had his head down. It was absolutely lashing rain. He said he didn't see a thing. And they rained kicks and punches on him. And he has a massive black eye. He has a huge bruise on his right shoulder, the same side mm-hmm. of that is where his eye is damaged, the right eye, and numerous other bruises around the back and the lower abdomen area. And he was left unconscious for about half an hour, possibly 40 minutes, bleeding in this laneway called the knock. And eventually he staggered onto his feet and he eventually found his way home in an awful condition.
And
he
was
remembers
one individual who attacked him or a group?
Two, he says, Joe, two, that they came from behind and they shouted at him, you foreign B-word, I won't say the word on live on air, you foreign B, go back to your own country. Originally, he's from Poland, as I might have mentioned at the start. Now, I don't know how they knew he was a foreign individual if they got him from behind. It's possible, and I'm reluctant to speculate too much, but it's possible that Chris may have had an altercation with them either that night or weeks and weeks previously if he was taking that route home. Honestly, Joe, I'm not sure. Chris says he didn't have any altercation with him that he remembers. Okay. But, you know, who really knows? And I have this image of him then because Chris told me he was covering his head with his hands as the kicks and punches were raining on him. And I just like felt so sorry for him at that image at 10 past, or whatever it was, coming up to midnight on a Wednesday night, lashing rain, and my poor brother-in-law covering his head as kicks and punches were rained on him towards the end of this racially motivated, unprovoked attack, to the best of our knowledge.
You're adamant that Chris's attack was that he heard those words?
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. He's absolutely categorical about that. He heard those words, you foreign B-word. Go back to your own country.
But when you say they left him lying on the ground, was he for half an hour? How did they know he wasn't dead?
I don't know, Joe. They and the strange thing as well about it is he had all his possessions on him, like he had his phone, he had his wallet. Mm. It just looks like this was some kind of a grudge or some kind of an attack for either some specific reason that we don't know about, or not that there's, by the way, there's no good reason for that.
Exactly, sounds like just a savage racist attack.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Because of his nationality.
Yeah, and he's had nothing but positive experiences generally since he moved here in 2016. In September 2016, he moved here because he would have had certain personal issues in Poland, and my family, my wife and his mother who lives here, and his brother as well, felt that a change of scenery would do him good. And so he came here in 2016. And overwhelmingly mm-hmm. positive is his general experience. Now, he would have experienced what I would like to call low-level racist comments. Like, some people might call it, Asher, you know, he's only messing kind of thing. Like, people might say, obviously without naming the people mm-hmm. and the places and the geographical locations, people might say, similar to what he heard that night. You know, all you foreigners coming over here taking our jobs.
Oh,
and the ironic thing was, Joe, he was in a highly skilled job where the person that he was working for was struggling to get Irish labour. So very often with these things.
And can you even look at the UK at the minute? Where they told people in 2016, they told foreigners to go back home and they took the advice. And now the country is grinding to a halt.
Yeah, absolutely. You can see that with the petrol shortage in the UK now.
Well,
that's
only the beginning, apparently. And there's been lots of issues about the supply chain and coming up to Christmas and various other workers as well, a shortage of. And Dane, did Chris simply lie there unconscious, or how did he get away?
That's what he said anyway, Joe, that after the attack, after they had finished, they basically left him for dead, and approximately half an hour, because he remembers checking his phone when he got home. He got home at approximately 1 o'clock in the morning. He vaguely remembers looking at his phone and seeing 1 o'clock. He would have got to the knock area, that laneway, at approximately 12 o'clock. So by subtracting the numbers, he thinks he was kind of unconscious. Maybe he was in a bit of shock. for approximately half an hour, 40 minutes, and he eventually staggered home then in a terrible state. And he never wanted to go to the guards at all. I only found out the next day when my wife, which is a sister, rang me to tell me the next day. And I eventually convinced him to go to the guards and report this. Because
I'm looking at the photograph here from the Westford People. I presume he went to hospital.
He didn't go to hospital. Actually, there's another story to that, Joe. He's actually in the hospital now, believe it or not, because in a either related or unrelated incident, which I'll go into detail which in a moment. But the first thing we went to the guards, mm-hmm. and reported it, and we were in a consultation room with a very professional and very courteous guard called Mick Carroll, who's heading the investigation. Mm-hmm. And he said he was shocked. He said it's incredibly unusual for this to happen, but he took pictures of the injuries that were there to see. We went to the doctor then the next day, because Garda Carroll said recommends going to the doctor, even though Kristen wasn't really a fan of it. But we went anyway, and the doctor said he examined him and gave him a thorough examination, doesn't see any reason to go to the hospital because it was just looks like scratches and bruises. And we went to the dentist as well because he had two loose teeth. But then yesterday, Joe, he was in bed lying, resting in the afternoon, and he ended up getting a seizure.
Oh, God.
And we couldn't believe this because there's no history of seizures in his family at all. He never had a seizure before. And he was foaming at the mouth. He fell off the bed. Eventually, his mother got in touch with my wife and myself. She hasn't got the best English, so we ended up bringing an ambulance anyway. And thankfully, the seizure was over by the time the ambulance came. And just linking in with the previous segment, Joe, I have to commend the ambulance service because mm-hmm. when I rang them, they were literally there, which in his apartment is close to the centre of Wexford town. They were there within less than 10 minutes. And they were the most professional, friendly, most wonderful people we could meet. They calmed Chris down, they checked his blood pressure, all that kind of stuff, and took him to the hospital. Now he's getting tests, he's undergoing scans. It could be something related to the beating. I'm sure it's probably not unrelated anyway. And at the moment, he's up in Wexford Hospital recovering.
Well, hopefully. And the Gardaí, is there any CCTV?
Well, actually, I was talking to the Garda Carroll. No, there's no. Unfortunately, there's no CCTV that he's aware of. He had a look at the place. He swept the place. He did a few door-to-doors. He couldn't find any CCTV there. He did say it would probably be a long shot that we would actually find out what transpired that night because it was so dark, no witnesses that we can be aware of. And all I can say is I'm grateful to the Wexford people and Tádhg Bearne, the journalist, and yourself for allowing us to highlight this issue because nobody deserves this. And
absolutely, absolutely.
Poor Chris, he's the most gentle, most kind-hearted person, and for this to happen to him is just utterly horrendous.
Okay. I'll pass on our kind regards. That's Dane Tighe talking about his brother-in-law, Chris Kudzik, 39 years of age, who... as I say, they shouted racist expletives at him and then attacked him from behind in Wexford town. Dane Tighe, thanks indeed. That's Dane Tighe.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Dane.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And Joe at RT.ie. Breda O'Byrne. Breda, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You were watching, as I say, a lot of people were that...
Yeah.
That
yes,
documentary on RT last night called Sold, the Aircom Shares Saga, 1999. The government privatised Telecom Éireann as it was then. And though they denied it now, they deny it then. They deny it now. And it was denied in the programme last night that any government minister encouraged people to buy shares. But over half a million people, it was a frenzy. Over half a million people bought shares. And the vast majority of them lost all of it because the shares were worth nothing after a few weeks. And unless you had a stockbroker account on the first few days where you could go and sell your shares, you were badly, badly stung. Were you stung, Breda?
Yes. I held on to the shares. But eventually I got rid of them. I didn't get rid of them. I went through the whole lot. I was at the AGM. In actual fact, I was looking at myself last night and my husband. We were sitting two rows behind Shane Ross and Eamon Dunphy, and it brought it all back to me, all the people that were there, and all the people felt that they felt they were done, and as one man said last night, and that is true. I have to thank RTE for showing that programme. It is good to show that, to remind...
But with your blood pressure not going, it was a great programme.
Well, you're on the kind of going there and out about a stroke and everything, and I'd say something. But what I did after, when the programme was over, I have all the cuttings from the papers.
Okay.
I always intended to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't go to bed until about 3 or 4 o'clock this morning, reading all the papers and all what happened in Aircom. And
how much did you lose, Breda?
I definitely saw a loss of 50%, I would say, of 8,000.
Oh, God.
Yeah, but I mean, people.
Now, what do you think?
With the other shares.
I know, but they're worth very little. But what do you think of the government now saying, "Should we didn't encourage anyone to buy it? Was you do it at your own risk?"
Oh yes. You see, what I think happened was they were going to privatise the company. It would be the first of those companies in Ireland, and of course, the people of Ireland are against privatisation, which they are in many countries. And I think then the whole idea was to get the ordinary people in the sale, so then they won't protest against the company, going private. That's what I think, really, and that's how they brought us all in. And, you know, and the minister at that time, she said, I have it here in black and white. I just read now what it is. It was in the Independent. And she said, while she did not want to be missed, to be mistaken for an Irish Margaret Thatcher, she hoped the country would mutate into a nation of shareholders.
But Mary O'Rourke said quite clearly last night that she never encouraged anyone to buy Aircom shares.
She did. She also said every Tom and Mary should have them. I have papers here and all that actually on it. And another thing too, and then they didn't want the ordinary shareholders to sell the shares. They wanted them to hold on. And they would give them free. If you hold on to your shares now for 12 months, we will give you an extra share for every 25 you would hold. And that's why so many ordinary people held on to shares. But, you know, what people don't know is that when you float free shares, you are reducing the price, the actual, you know, share price. So that was something that people didn't realise as well. Like myself, I learned all that since.
But the government of the time, there was Bertie Ahern, Charlie McCreevy, Mary O'Rourke, Ray McSherry was chairman. He was a former Minister of Finance. There were four people.
There was a cabinet subcommittee.
Yeah, but they said we didn't encourage anyone to buy shares in Aircom.
They did, actually.
Well, Mary O'Rourke said it again last night. She said, search high and low and you will not find any reference
to me. But look at all the advertisements.
Well, they were put in by Telecom. But what's the quote you have there from Mary O'Rourke in your cuttings from 20 years ago? Because somebody sent, I mentioned this earlier, here's from the Evening Herald in June 1999, sharing it out. Minister Mary O'Rourke with Forage Armstrong, a Telecom Share Information Centre.
What happened was with the shares.
Just let me finish this. The minister can't buy shares. Well, we knew that, so she couldn't buy any because of her position. But she wants as many ordinary people to invest as possible. Now, that's a caption under a photograph. Now, there's another quote, and again, it's from an article. Once again, by the ever diligent and brilliantly researched Fintan O'Toole. And this is going back 20 years now. And he dug up a quote from Mary O'Rourke, who was addressing the Communication Workers Union, who did very well out of it as well. The workers did very well out of the share flotation, even though before that it was a basket case of a company. You couldn't get a phone line or whatever. She said, through a widespread shareholding in the citizens in conjunction with the employees will be able to share in the successes of the company and to have a say in the development over the coming years. This is Mary Rook. This is my view. It's the essence of what being a public means, a company means, a company which is literally owned by the people through the widest possible ownership. It is my firm intention that there should be significant tranche of the shares available to citizens. This is a personal objective of mine, one I know that my government colleagues share. It is entirely appropriate that the public reap the benefits of this success. So what Mary Rook says, I didn't encourage anyone to buy shares. Why are you looking at me?
Well, yes, Mary Rook did, and they were all Charlie McCreevy and the whole lot, like, and I mean, we
they're
went
all,
down...
They're, well, they're all retired now, in fairness, so they're not in the public... Well, Mary Workers isn't the public eye. She appears a lot on radio and television.
But the people would never have bought into those shares. Sure. When you look at it, really, what the ordinary shareholders really hadn't much say in that company because there were huge investment funds.
And when it came to a vote...
That was the day you were there.
There was 4,000 ordinary Joes, so to speak, in Joe's.
Yeah, and you know what happened at that meeting?
Yeah.
I remember I went in early. I was there about 9 o'clock. That's why I was sitting here at the front. And it was a very warm day.
Okay.
And I remember the building in the RDS, it was all done in black and white, real dark, no idea.
Okay.
And we went, it was like a big cave, and there we were. And there we were inside there, and the air condition was on. And do you know what happened at about 3 o'clock? They turned the air condition off so that we'd go home or fall asleep.
Okay, good.
That happened at that meeting.
Okay, but you were outvoted because Ray McSherry, who was the then chairman, stood up and said, I've got 1.3 billion votes in my proxy votes.
That's
from
right.
From financial companies. Eddie, good afternoon. Eddie, you bought shares as well in Aircom. How did you do?
I made money, actually, Joe.
And how'd you do that? Fair play.
Well, I went down to Northern Bank. We're offering
loans. All the banks. There were signs in the windows of the banks. Are you thinking of buying shares in Aircom or Telecom as well? Come in and ask for a loan. And the credit unions as well.
Yeah, it was a three-month interest-free loan.
Yeah.
Now, I hadn't got a bean, but I had an account with Northern Bank.
Okay.
And I went in and I said... I knew these had to go up the minute they were bought.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And I went in anyway, and I says, a loan. Yeah, I says, how much do you want? She says, how much will you give me? So he says, how much do you want? So I said, so give us 10 grand. And he says, okay, come back the next day. So I'm back the next day. So he will give you 6.
Okay.
The thing was, they bought the shares.
Ah.
And they held on to them.
So that means they could sell them? Because the only people...
No. They bought them for you, but held on to them as collateral.
Yeah, but they were stockbrokers as well. The only people who could sell their shares in the first few days when the price went up were people who had an account with a stockbroker. So the vast majority of ordinary Joes and Josephines don't have an account with a stockbroker. So they held on to their shares and they were told you're going to get an extra share after 12 months. But the people who offloaded their shares in the first few days, they're the ones who made the money.
Yeah. And
Eddie?
When you have a loan, it concentrates the money. Or they concentrate the money,
and the money. Yeah.
Yeah, but I was watching the shares and they went up and up. And after about 10 or 11 days, they stopped. And then started to go down. And I immediately hot-footed it into the bank.
Well done. You said sell. You ran in and said sell.
And they said, right, we'll sell X amount of shares.
Okay.
And I covered the loan. And they said, and there's €240 gone into your, or punts, whatever it was at the time, gone into your account.
Well done. But the point I'm making is the vast majority of the over 500,000 people who bought shares in 1999 didn't have... They bought them personally and they came in their hall door and they didn't, you couldn't sell them unless you hired a stockbroker, and a lot of people don't know how to do that. But you made the brilliant move of the Northern Bank holding the shares, and all you had to say to them was sell.
Yeah, and that's basically,
This argument now, the government of the time saying, we never encouraged anyone to buy shares.
No, I can't remember, but I mean, there were so many, every Tom, Dick and Harry was buying shares.
I know. Everyone, and the vast majority of people lost a lot of money.
Friends of mine, and they used their own money. As I say, using borrowed money.
But if you had waited and they weren't worth the paper, they were... written on, because they sold off the mobile phone wing and then they went.
Yeah, I still have a couple of hundred, Joe.
Okay, well, hold on to them at this stage.
As I say,
Eddie,
there,
why have you given that? Given that you're one of the
sharpest
people with money I've come across. Well, do you have the lottery numbers for tomorrow night? It's 19 million.
I wish I had.
Okay. Thanks, Eddie. That's Eddie in Swords and Breda in Kilkenny on the Aircom shares debacle, which the government of the day are now saying had nothing to do with us. Back after this.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
I mentioned earlier in a completely different topic about Peter Navin, who was on with us on, I think, the 24th of September. The clock was ticking because he was retiring from Dublin Fire Brigade, but he discovered if he was not married to his partner, Carmel, by the date of his retirement, his pension, if God forbid that happened to him, would be lost. And the clock was ticking. It's now the 5th of October, and 5 days have passed. Peter Navin, good afternoon.
Do you great, Joseph?
Can I sit down to you? Very good. What's happened?
It's fair to say, Joseph, that your programme started a ripple that turned into a tsunami.
I'm now
standing in a suite in the Louis Fitzgerald Hotel looking for my glasses because the room is so big. shortly after the programme, DFB HR reached out to me and offered to extend my retirement. This was followed by DCC HR the next day at 8:30, confirming that my retirement was now put on hold.
Oh, very good.
And then about an hour later, I got an email from the General Registrar's Office to say that the GRO in Roscommon Legal Department now accepted the bona fide days and the sworn statement by my ex-wife, and that I was now free to marry. Which is just as well, Joe, because the letter never arrived.
And still the letter from the UK, which would have recorded the fact that you had a divorce in the UK, that was the big delay. But everyone else has got around the bureaucracy and... Yeah, so are you married?
No, tomorrow at 1:30. The GRO are squeezing me in on their lunch break. They've reached out. Joe, seriously, it has been absolutely fantastic.
Oh, that's fantastic.
From DFB management, DCC management, the Registrar's Office, the Louis Fitzgerald Hotel through Neve, it's been fantastic. Everybody has pulled together.
So you're getting married at 1:30 tomorrow in...
Tomorrow at 1:30, I walk up the aisle with Carmel Daly and then walk down the aisle with Carmel Navin.
and she can keep her own name if she wants as well. But anyway, so where is the ceremony taking place?
Sir Patrick Dunne's Hospital.
Oh, yeah, the registry
office downtown Dublin.
And can many people go at the minute?
Unfortunately, with COVID, we are down to 4 guests each.
Okay.
But then afterwards, we will be retiring to local hostelries and then back to the hotel for a few afterwards.
Okay.
So, 4 guests each, masked up, suitably. Suited and booted.
Okay. And do you have to make a speech tomorrow?
I will probably have to say a word or two, in which it'll be every toast will be to Joe. and crew, because seriously, without you raising the subject, I'd still be looking at me far and fish going past and he'd be ringing people about me at this stage.
Okay, well, that's brilliant, and congratulations, and I hope everything goes well.
Thank you very much,
well,
Joe.
Tomorrow.
Could I just comment on from the top of your programme?
Yeah, absolutely.
If you still have time, just with the 36 years with the Fire Service, the delays at the moment, they're endemic. They're in the system. They're not only DFB, they're HSE as well. David Hall spoke very well. David's around in the game as long as I am.
Yeah.
But at the moment, any given evening, you could have 2-3 hours of delays within Dublin. And I know that within the country, for an ambulance to be sent from Wexford to Dublin for a case or from Ballinasloe to Mullingar for a case is not uncommon. And it's unfair. The people on the ground, the workers on the ambulance service, the people in the control room, they are fantastic. They are so professional. But part of their duties now is to have to apologise. For them to have to turn up the case and apologise.
Yeah.
David said,
so what's the solution, Peter?
the solution has to be for all the stakeholders to get together and sit down at, at ministerial level.
So that is the job of the minister, to pull everyone together and sort this out.
Yeah, the delays were there before COVID. Unfortunately, COVID has compounded
of course,
all the PPE and then the decontamination of ambulances afterwards, but it's countrywide.
Okay.
But the crews, they do work hand in hand on the ground, and they are so professional.
Well, something needs to be done. I agree. But
when
will you retire?
Joe, when all of those people, the stakeholders, sit down, they should have the voices of all of your callers ringing in their ears.
Okay.
Listening to all their stories.
Well, Peter, I hope it's congratulations, and here comes the bride ringing your ears at this time tomorrow. good health and happiness to yourself and Carmel and your extended family. That's Peter
Navin. Thank you very much, sir.
Well done. Well done, Slán.
And
thank you for your fantastic service and everyone in their first responders nationwide. Back tomorrow, 1:45, Lisa Marie Berry produced, and Ray Darcy's next.
E-Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the Kia e-range of EVs and PHEVs.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
1850 715 815. Stays open until 3:15 p.m. Or email joe@rte.ie.